everybody. We've got an extra special edition for you of Authors Are Rockstars with Nova Ren Suma, Suzanne Young, Cindy Pond, and Holly Goldberg Sloan. Just to let you know, they have a signing going on today in Montrose, California at Once Upon a Time. You can go to bridgetobooks.org and look for YA Rising Stars, and they have all the information about the event. All right, well, let's get to the interview.
Welcome to a special edition of Authors Are Rockstars. Joining us today, we have Cindy Pond, Suzanne Young, Nova Ren Suma, and Holly Goldberg Sloan. Thank you so much for joining us today, ladies. It's awesome of you to take time out of your schedules to talk with us. Thank you so much.
We're going to start today's interview with you, Suzanne. First, I just want to say, wow, And Meet So Beautiful is such a powerful and unique book. You had me in tears by the end. Your twist on Angels is... it's really interesting. Can you tell our listeners a little bit about what inspired your novel?
Yeah, I Need So Beautiful, I actually thought of it a few years ago, and I had a relative who was sick, and I was told that they were going to die, and I was having trouble dealing with that, and so one day I went to IKEA to go shopping, kind of get my mind off of it, and this little old lady came and sat next to me and ended up just talking to me for like 30 minutes about her husband and how he passed away. And she told me to go home and gave me this great advice. And so I left, and I never even bought anything at IKEA. And I went home, and I thought to myself, like, did that really happen? Like, how did she know exactly what to say to me at that moment? And it made me think, like, what if there's really just these angels that you meet, and they give you this one piece of advice that changes your life? And so that's what started the idea of The Forgotten.
Oh, that is so cool. Wow. That's amazing. So your first series, The Naughty List, it was contemporary, but A Need So Beautiful, of course, is paranormal. Was it difficult to switch gears between the two genres?
It really was. A Need So, The Naughty List was fun to write. Like, we would sit around the dinner table and yell out, like, different alternative curse words, like, the great Caesar's ghost. With A Need So Beautiful, we didn't really get to do that. I was mostly crying while I was typing it. But I originally wrote Need So Beautiful. I had this paranormal element. But I wrote it as a contemporary and then slowly threaded in the more supernatural elements.
Wow.
So.
That's really interesting. Yeah, that's really interesting.
That's cool.
All right, well, on to Cindy. The fantasy China setting of Silver Phoenix is so rich. Can you tell us about how you went about blending the real ancient China with the fantasy elements, like kind of research?
Yeah, I did a lot of, I bought a lot of huge coffee books with beautiful photos of China. I've never been to China. So it was, I guess what I do is I need to be immersed visually. So I got, you know, books on clothes. I got books on the Imperial Palace and the furniture and the books that he, you know, the emperor had in his private studies. And I got books on architecture of China. And just looking through that, I just kind of sucked it all in and tried to put a little bit of it into my stories. And I honestly think that writers, when they research, they usually don't even use half of the stuff that they research. It's just about being immersing yourself into that world and then trying to convey it in your prose. And I think if I try to use everything that I had seen, it would have been way too much. So that's how I got 2 years to do Silver Phoenix because it hadn't sold yet. So I had the leisure of, you know, buying as many books as I wanted and, you know, let's do this and let's do that. And hopefully one day I'll be able to go visit.
Oh my gosh, I hope
that's
so.
A dream.
Yeah, the setting was really amazing. I can't believe that you've never gone to China.
Yeah,
it just
thank
felt
you.
Really real.
Thank you.
So seriously, Chinese food. I was craving it so much while reading that book. So like, what's your favorite dish? And were those dishes like from your family? And tell us a little about that.
Well, the food is so funny because it's like its own character in my books. And I didn't mean for it to be, but it's just because I like to eat and it's so integral to Chinese culture itself. So, I mean, it was just natural for it to come into the story. And for me, I think that food is essential to world building. I mean, that's how I feel about it. So, and I think how a character relates to food as well kind of tells you how the character feels. I mean, my character Eileen is always eating. She likes to eat. If she's not eating, she doesn't have an appetite. You know that something's really wrong with her. Most of the dishes I put in there are what I've grown up eating. Mm-hmm. I usually don't put anything in there that I don't like to eat. So it's I like a lot of the bean curds and the tofu and the mixed vegetables and the seafoods and just everything. The noodles, the steamed buns. I mean, I could go on forever.
Okay, I'm getting hungry now.
Sorry.
So good.
Sorry. So it just came out naturally, and it was so funny because my crit group was like, oh, you need to, you know, come up with a companion cookbook.
Yes.
And the irony is I don't cook. My mom is such a great cook. She is the best Chinese cook I know. And I cannot cook. I can eat. Yes. And that's it. So for the Silver Phoenix paperback, my editor, Virginia, was like, could you give us a recipe to include in the author's extra? And I said, well, I don't cook, but I got my mom to give me the mapo tofu recipe, which is kind of like a spicy bean curd recipe. And so I put it in the back of the book, and it's Margaret's home style mapo tofu. So,
so
it was
cool.
A lot of fun. Yeah.
That was brilliant. Yeah, so good.
Thank you.
Oh, well, Nova, I just finished Imaginary Girls, and from the start, I was blown away. Oh my gosh. Your writing is so beautiful, and I don't know how to describe it. It's like magical, I guess. Have you found that your voice is just a little bit more lyrical? Or did you intentionally write Imaginary Girls to have this sort of tone?
Well, first of all, thank you so much. That's really, really nice, and I'm glad you enjoyed it.
Loved it.
The voice, I have to say, I've always been a very voicey writer. Everything I've written, it has a very strong voice. It might not be Chloe's voice, it would be another character's voice, but voice is actually one of the most important things to me in fiction. It's what I look for as a reader. My most favorite books are in first person, so when I write, the first thing I find is the voice. So it wasn't that I set out intentionally to write a very voicey book for Imaginary Girls, but I had Chloe's voice, and then the story sort of expanded from that. And she's very dreamy. She sort of imagines many things, and that really informed the shape of the book.
So your book involves a really strong familial relationship. Did your family help inspire that at all?
Actually, I have a sister, and the book is about two sisters. So in real life, I'm the big sister, and I have a little sister. Her name is Laurel Rose. And when I was in high school, she was, you know, like a little 5 years old, 6 years old. And I would take her with me all everywhere, and I absolutely adore my sister. So a lot of the sister relationship comes from that. But the Ruby character, the older sister in the book, is really an idealized version, a mythical version of an older sister, something I never could have been for my sister. So I can't say I'm Ruby. I'm a lot more like Chloe. But the sister dynamic is from, you know, my real life.
Oh, that's really amazing.
That's really neat. Holly, can you talk to us a little bit about your background writing screenplays? Like, how does that influence your young adult writing? Because this is your first young adult novel, correct?
Yes, it is. I've written for the last 25 years for film and television, and I've had 7 movies made. I've directed 3 movies. And I think that when you read my book, you can tell that I don't know what I'm doing. And,
I don't think so.
And I think that you can tell that I've written for film and television, because my book in some ways reads as if you're reading a movie. And that's just the way it came out. So I really admire the people I'm sitting next to, the 3 women, because I really know they know what they're doing. And
no, we don't.
And I don't. So, but I have been influenced by trying to tell stories from a visual point of view. And that's what I have tried to do in my book.
That's so cool. And I think readers, especially young adult readers, really love that. I mean, they want to picture the story in, you know, on the screen of their mind, you know. So I think that's why it speaks to so many people. So how did you decide on the particular Jackson 5 song that inspired the title of I'll Be There? Were there any other contenders for that honor?
I'll Be There wasn't the title of the book originally. Aww. And I retitled the book because the publishers felt that my original title was not broad enough.
Interesting.
The book was called For You, and it was a number 4 and a you. It was a text message. Mm-hmm. And it was part of something that happened in the book, but they felt that that was not really what the book was about, and that it seemed sort of pop and somewhat trendy. And so I decided to use the song. I changed that. And I'm glad I did, because the book has been sold for translation in quite a few places. And I now think that For You, the four and the you, I don't know what that would have done. Although now I find myself in the position of licensing the song, because I bought the song and I bought the title and I bought usage rights, which is a little unusual. And now I have to buy usage rights in Dutch and Finnish and Chinese and all these different languages. So I've set a nice bar for myself. but I'm used to that in film, because in film, if you want something like a song, you figure out who you know and you call them and you get the song. So that's, I called people I knew eventually. It was written by Barry Gordy and three other people, and it's in a library, and I went to the library and I got the song usage. But the truth is that that song in that library was originally a Motown song. It's not now overseas in the same library. So I have to go now country by country and find where the song is.
Wow.
It was a huge hit, and then it was in 1972, 73, and then it was a hit again in the 90s.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
It's something that I've never heard of before.
I know,
so it's kind of cool for our listeners to get to hear something like that.
Well, and that's really interesting because of your background. I mean, I don't know that other authors necessarily would have known what to do about the rights to a song.
You know, you can get the intellectual property.
Yeah.
You can go after the rights to almost anything. And you can negotiate. I did it all myself.
Mm-hmm.
So that tells you that you can do it. I did have Hey Jude in my first draft. And that was later in the book. There are two people singing, and I had them singing Hey Jude. I didn't attempt to get it because of so much controversy regarding Apple and the Beatles and licensing their songs. But I can tell you could get that.
Right.
I just didn't at the time. I thought it would be a lot of money, and I decided not to do it. But you could get that.
Interesting.
Cool. These questions are for all of you ladies. So if you have something to say, just kind of
chime in
a little bit and chime in. A lot of our listeners are aspiring writers that just love to hear stories about getting published. I mean, you guys have been there, you know, hitting the pavement and sending out those query letters. It can get you kind of down in the dumps.
Mm-hmm.
Can you guys share your stories of how you became to be these awesome published writers that you are today?
Okay, I'll go first.
Thanks, Suzanne.
It's my road was very bumpy. I wrote my first book, which was terrible, and it was like 100,000 words, and it wasn't very good. It was my fifth book that I got my agent after querying 100 agents.
Wow.
We went on sub, and it was out 9 months, and then I didn't sell, and then she ended up dropping me.
Oh.
So I was completely distraught. I thought about quitting, and then I decided to just send it out on my own without an agent, and I had gotten an offer from Razorbill, and I had gotten another agent from there. And so now I'm on my, I have an agent, Jim McCarthy at Distel & Gomerich, who's fantastic, and I'm with Balzer & Bray and Simon Pulse. So it was just, I could have quit at that time because it was just so disheartening. But I kept going and I kept writing books because my first book published was the fifth or sixth book I wrote, and A Need So Beautiful is my 13th book.
Yeah.
So just keep writing.
That is awesome to hear. That's amazing.
And I remember back in, I think it was 2008 when we met for the first time, and it was just all starting to happen because we had known each other from online on a writing forum, and it was just so exciting. I mean, it's just so exciting. It takes so much persistence, I think, to get published, and it's not getting any easier to get published traditionally and to get an agent. And talent helps. I mean, they say write a good book, and that helps, but I know so many people who, like, on the forums are like, I queried 12 agents, and they said no, and I quit. And I'm like, what? 12 agents? I mean, you really have to have a thick skin.
Yeah.
So for me, Silver Phoenix was actually the first novel I ever wrote. And so I queried, and I loved it. I finished it, and I thought, oh, well, you know, I did so much work on it. Why don't I just try and query?
Yeah.
And so that was why I was hanging out on the writing forum. I queried 121 agents and got over 100 rejections.
Oh.
And it was really, really hard to get an agent because what they do is they look on the shelves and at the current market, and they say, we don't see anything that's anything like your book right now. So I have no idea who's going to buy it. So they were leery. They were timid. They'd say, I really love the story, but I can't represent you because I don't know who to pitch it to. So that was a real challenge, and that was heartbreaking, and I was thinking of going through the slush piles and going to publishers that would take an unagented writer. That would be my next step. But unfortunately, Bill Contardi took me. And so the good news is that I actually went on sub, and I had three publishers who were interested in Silver Phoenix, which was fantastic, which was about the same amount of agents who were willing to look at Fold because they were so leery. And so, I mean, I think that the good news is that don't believe, you know, what the agents say. It's so subjective. And if somebody falls in love with your book, even if there's nothing that's exactly like it, they're still looking for multicultural stories. And they were interested in Silver Phoenix. And I went with Green Willow, and I've loved being published with them, which is part of HarperCollins.
Oh.
So that was how... That was my...
And I remember that, because that was
awesome.
Such a big deal when you got published.
Oh,
so excited. We were all like, woo!
You guys are so
fun.
Sweet.
That's really inspiring. That's
Thank
really
you.
Cool.
Thank you.
I guess I'm going to try and condense my story so it's not so long. But I didn't start off writing for young adults. I thought I wanted to write for adults. So I, straight out of college, I went and got an MFA at Columbia University. Oh, wow. And my plan was to write adult novels. And I wrote one that was my thesis. It was 500 pages, sort of semi-autobiographical. And I can't even describe the plot if that says something. I mean, it was just... So I wrote that novel, and I showed it to basically two people, to a top agent who was like my dream agent, and my mom. And the top agent was kindly rejected me, and my mom was just, I think, a little taken aback that I had taken so much of our personal history with my family and put it into this novel for the world to see. And her reaction really made me realize that I maybe shouldn't have written or shouldn't expose that. So I sort of took a step back from that novel. And I did stories, I wrote a whole other adult novel, and I queried widely for agents, and I could not get a bite. And the novel that I wrote, the second novel, was from teenage perspectives, but it never occurred to me that I was that I could try writing a young adult novel. It just, in my MFA program, it had never come up. All the books I read were for adults. It just, it never occurred to me. But I always wrote about teenagers. And then... I worked in publishing. I worked as a copy editor for years. And through my connections at my day job, I started doing ghostwriting and work for hire writing in for children's books. So I wrote movie adaptations and novels under fake names for middle grade readers. And it was through that experience that I got my first actual book deal under my real name without an agent. At a different publisher, Simon & Schuster, and that was Danny Noir, which came out in 2009. That was a middle grade novel. And that led to me getting the courage to actually go back and look for an agent for a young adult novel this time, and that was Imaginary Girls. So this was 10 years worth of, you know, I was really disheartened by the reaction from when I was trying to get an agent in the adult world, and I thought I really was going to give up. But the Danny Noir thing sort of happened and fell in my lap, and I realized I love writing about teenagers so much, and I love writing from this voice. And then I realized I could write a young adult novel, and everything changed. And when I got an agent very quickly, and we sold the book very quickly at an auction, and it was just like the exact opposite of everything that had gone on all those years before. It was very surreal.
That's amazing. So, that's so inspiring. I love these stories. Oh, my gosh.
Now, what about you, Holly? Because you came from a completely different background, so I'm really interested to hear your story.
Yeah. I don't think that my story is very inspiring. because I'm doing it all the wrong way. So I'm swimming backwards by writing movies and then going the reverse direction. So I had representation when when I wrote my book. I was at a place called Endeavor. Actually, now it's William Morris Endeavor. Although I ended up leaving them and going to Writer's House in New York for my book. But it's a different game if you're already in. So it's like baseball. I was already on a team. I got traded. But you'd have to go back to originally how I got an agent. And I would say that was in my 20s. I'm 52. I'll be 53 tomorrow.
Wow. And, Happy
and I've been writing since I was 25. I've been in the Writers Guild for a long time. And I would encourage young writers, forgetting my experience because, again, it's irrelevant. I would encourage you to write. I would encourage you to show as many people as possible. I would encourage you to enter contests and awards. I would encourage you to do things like we're right now all in the hotel room, Nova's hotel room, at a conference. And I think that there are real things to be learned by going to conferences and understanding the system. Again, to use a baseball analogy, because I did write the movie Angels in the Outfield, you need to know what the game is. So even if you are buying a ticket and you're sitting in the stands, which is what I think a lot of conferences are like, and that's what a lot of film festivals are about, you're sitting there and you're watching the game, and that helps you to understand that there are rules of how the game is played. And at any one time, there are probably, in case of baseball, 9 superstars on the field, but there are a lot of people that get those guys on the field, and there are a lot of people who make a living tangentially from the fact that that game's being played. And you don't have to be the biggest slugger in baseball. You don't even you can be on a double A team, or I don't know, I'm carrying the baseball thing a little far. But I really like sports. But what I'm saying is that there's a place for you if you love the game. If you like it and you want to be part of it, I think you should always aim to be on the field and be the biggest hitter, but you don't have to be to have a great life. But you have to show up.
Yes.
You have to show up. Right? So show up and do it, and it'll lead to great things. And I think that there is no single path to doing it. Mm-hmm. So, but it is good to hear people's stories. And the not giving up part, I find fantastic.
That is so cool. I love all these stories. It's so inspirational and really insightful. So thank you so much, ladies. That's awesome. So we usually ask a question here on Authors Are Rockstars pertaining to music. Since the tone of a few of these books is a little serious for our usual question of who would sing what at karaoke, maybe you could tell us if there's a certain type of music you associate with any of your novels, or like playlists, songs that you were inspired by, you know.
Well, there was a song that sort of inspired the beginning of Imaginary Girls. It's a song that my sister introduced me to by an artist, Leaky Lee, and it's called Hanging High from her first album, Youth Novels. And my sister always introduces me to music. She introduced me to Cat Power, which inspired some of the writing as well. But this song, I don't have it with me that I can play it for you, but the lyrics in it inspired the opening scene at the reservoir in my novel.
Wow.
Where there's, I don't want to give anything away, but a body is found and there's hints of other things going on beneath the surface. And I was so inspired by the song that I think it propelled the plot of the book and changed what I had originally planned.
Wow. So. That's awesome. Thank you, Nova.
Why don't you sing a little bit of that? I can't sing.
That would be a first. Yeah. On Authors Are Rockstars. That'd be awesome. So how about you, Will Holly?
I already answered that song, question.
So
I'm deferring on that question.
You're off the hook for that one. How
and
about
also,
you, Suzanne?
I have a playlist on my website.
Right.
And so you can link to that. And also, I'm musically a complete moron. So to somebody else.
Okay, Suzanne, go for it.
For me, well, it's funny because the book is so gold, but I was inspired by a movie, which is The Crow.
Oh.
And that was kind of very dark. That was the mood I was going for in the book. Mm-hmm. And so I tried to pull up the soundtrack and it didn't quite work. So I listened to a lot of Radiohead. For whenever I was writing for the love interest Harlan, I listened to a lot of Kings of Leon because I think the lead singer is smoking hot. So whenever I hear his voice, I'm like, oh, that's Harlan. But the song that really works for it is Iris by the Goo Goo Dolls. Oh, like okay. The words for it work really well with the need so beautiful.
Ooh, very cool. How about you, Cindy?
Well, I don't know if you guys write to the music. I can't write because I'm a singer alonger. So I mean, it's awful. So I can't. I know the song, so I can't play anything that I actually know because I'll be singing along. So what happened was I'll listen to classical music, which I'm not very familiar with, but I need the noise and I like that. But I listened to a lot of Jay Chou for Fury of the Phoenix, and he's like this mega super Asian rock star that like all of Asia listens to and has like the number one ringtone, and everybody's like, who is this person? But he actually is a bad actor. And is it the Green Lantern that he was in, or the Green? The one with Seth, what's his name?
Green Hornet.
So he was the one that played Kato.
Oh,
and so he's him. He's very cute. So
I don't think he's a bad actor. I don't think we shouldn't ever say that.
You know,
especially because that's my friend's movie.
So oh, yes, no!
He's not a bad actor.
No, he's
a good actor.
So, and then I saw there's a song in there he sang for Curse of the Golden Flower was a film that came out. So he has a song in there that I listen to. And I can listen to his songs because my Chinese isn't good enough that I can sing along.
Oh.
So it works very well. And he sings like these very emo ballads. And it works perfectly for Fury of the Phoenix. So that's what I listen to.
Okay. I'm going to go search for his music.
Yes, please.
That he was a musician in addition to being an actor.
Yeah,
so
he's a good singer.
All right, well, all of you have really gorgeous book covers. Did you have any input on them?
You know, it's funny because I had a very different experience with my first book. So with A Need So Beautiful, the day that my editor bought the book, she called to tell me like she had an idea already for the book cover. And I was at this conference last year when she emailed me from the photo shoot, the model that they had.
Wow.
And she was so pretty. And I was like, I was really happy with it. And then I saw the cover and I loved it, but it wasn't until I saw the full jacket and could see her hair went all the way around and the colors and everything that I I was really happy. And so they were just trying to go with beautiful as the kind of the theme. So it worked, I was
happy.
It's
a pretty good theme.
Yeah, I didn't have any input other than just going, yeah, I love it.
It's great. Lovely. I think it looks great on my shelf. So, yeah.
It's gorgeous. Every time I see that girl, I think of you.
That's all right. Let's just pretend
I'm like,
that is me.
No, totally. For me, my original cover, I actually had a lot of input on, which had the Chinese American model on it. And so they, you know, asked me, and usually don't get a lot. Thank you. Usually don't get a lot of input. So she wanted to know the hair. She has a single braid. You know, what costumes we should get. And I, like, found links online for Chinese clothes to wear. The second cover, I didn't have as much say because I got repackaged. So they were just trying to go for a completely different look in that. More paranormal, more dark. Since the first one was so bright and it just didn't work out as well,
really,
unfortunately.
Epic,
it was very epic, but I mean, the booksellers didn't know what to do with it.
Yeah.
It didn't fit on the shelves. They thought it was middle gray because it was bright pink. And I mean, it's just like really, you don't even know how much, you know, covers affect marketing and how it's perceived and how challenging it is to come up with a cover that conveys what it conveys, because my cover did convey what it conveyed, but it didn't convey it in the way that the market knew how to deal with it. So,
well, that's really interesting to hear too, because of a lot of these new websites that are coming out, like HarperCollins has their Ink Pop website where these aspiring writers are on there, and they're actually like producing with their own covers. So it's kind of interesting for them to hear when you actually do have input on your covers, kind of what the process was. How about you, Nova? Did you have any input?
I've been saying the cover of Imaginary Girls is an underwater photograph by a underwater photographer, Elena Callis, and it's taken in the Bahamas. It's this beautiful, I love it so much. And when everyone will come up to me and say, I love your cover, I say, oh, I had nothing to do with it, it's the publisher. But it's really funny, I recently had to go back and look at all my editorial letters for the book because I'm helping my editor with a workshop on Monday. So I was reading through my editorial letters, and very early on she asked me, do you have any ideas for the cover? And I said, girls underwater. And I completely forgot that I told her that.
And you had everything to do with it.
And I realized they listened to me. They completely, like, they listened to me and they gave me, like, my dream cover. And I had... It means so much more when I look back on that, and I can't believe I didn't even. So I'm sorry, Dutton, that I didn't remember that. I mean, I'm so happy with it.
That's awesome. Yeah, it's really eye-catching. And Holly, I can't stop looking at your cover. It's so gorgeous. So yeah, did you have any input on that one?
Well, as you can see, you've got an arc right there, and I'm one of the few people who has an arc that has no cover.
That was interesting in itself.
It was interesting in it of itself. It's somewhat reminiscent of Catcher in the Rye. So they just, in terms of the cover, not necessarily the book. So we had a lot of trouble coming up with the cover. And I think, I love my cover. It was done by Neil Schwab. And it's a piece of original art. And I was very happy with it. And then right in the end, I got an email. I was in the dentist's office. And it said... we've decided to change the cover. And they said, we're sending you the new cover. And so I said to the dentist, I need to look at this. And I actually got up out of the chair. But I sent back a quick text that said, I know I'll love it because I love the first cover so much. So if you think you've improved it, it can only get better. And then I went into the hall and he heard me go, what? And with some expletives thrown in there. So I came back in and told him that I needed 5 minutes. And I went and I called New York and said, I really, really don't like the new cover. The cover of my book right now is a piece of original art. And it's the two boys at sunset. And they're up on a hill. And it's very graphic. And the cover that they're proposing was a guitar in some wet leaves. And it looked like the Janis Ian autobiography, My Crappy Life. I mean, it was just so depressing and horrible. So then I called and I said, I know I have no input on cover, but I've been through it quite a bit in movies. And I just feel like you need to pick your battles. And so I decided to pick this one. And I said, you know, of course, I have no input. So contractually, you can do whatever you want. But I will, if anyone ever asks me what I think of the cover, I'll have to tell them that I loathe it.
I love the honesty.
Listen, loathing isn't hating, because loathing's worse. So I will tell them I loathe it, and I will tell them there was a cover I loved. But I will, of course, support my book. And it was really quiet, and they said, you know, we're going to call you back. So... 2 hours later, I got a call back. I was driving around town with my mom, and my mom has vision issues and hearing issues, and so I had had to yell to her, I hate my cover. And she can't see any of the covers, so she would just look and say, I think it's bad because you think it's bad. And then the phone rang, and it was Little Brown, and they said, we've decided to revert back to your first cover. However, you now got pushed 2 weeks. I think they must have printed the bad cover because because my release date got changed from May 3rd to May 17th. And I was actually going out on book tour. So it did present some problems. But I do love my cover. I know they're beautiful. Going to...
Really nice. It's stunning.
They're going to change my cover when we go to paperback. But that often happens. So I'm totally fine. And maybe we're going to go to the cover I love. The guitar in the weeds. So if we do, I'm going to No, I don't
They'll
care.
They'll change it now.
But I love Little Brown.
Well, that's awesome that they did listen to you in the end. And, you know, it is a gorgeous cover. So that's it all worked out for the best. So since you all write for teens, what were some of the favorite teen books from your teen years?
I read tons of Stephen King. Like, I loved any kind of horror. A little bit of V.C. Andrews, but mostly Stephen King. Like, everything Stephen King.
Good stuff, yeah.
How about you, Cindy?
I read a lot of Stephen King, too, actually. I read Agatha Christie. I did a lot of, because there wasn't as much middle... Yeah. Well, there was middle grade, but there wasn't as much YA. Mm-hmm. I read Sweet Valley High.
Of course. True.
And then all those... Is it the Sunfire romance?
I loved those.
The ones Rebecca and Nora. Jacqueline.
Nicole.
All the ones... There was the Hollywood one, Cassandra. Yes, Roxanne. So, and I think they're Scholastic books. And so we were reminiscing about that on Twitter. And it was always, it was very adult romance, actually. It was the girl in the middle, and then it was always two guys on the side.
And you could tell which one she was going to choose. Yes. It was always two guys. Like, it was a, what do you call that? Like a montage? Like a collage sort of type thing.
Illustrated, and I read almost all of those, I think.
Yes,
so.
They were epic.
Yeah.
I didn't read YA books when I was in high school, probably because there weren't as many.
Right.
But I remember a book that I was obsessed with in junior high was Go Ask Alice. I must have read that 20 times. I'd give it out to my friends, and they wouldn't give it back. I'd have to buy it again. And I read, you know, Flowers in the Attic. I had a little bit of an obsession with at that point. But the writer that really changed me when I was a teenager and made me decide that I wanted to become a writer was Margaret Atwood. I found her books on my mom's bookshelf. My mom was a big reader, which is probably why I'm a writer today. And I first read Cat's Eye, and then I read A Handmaid's Tale, and I just felt like maybe I could do this. And that changed everything for me.
Oh, that's awesome. How about you, Holly?
Well, I think I fall in the same camp as Nova because when I'm older than everyone in the hotel. And so when I was growing up, there wasn't a category YA. You just read books. And in high school, my favorite writer was Faulkner.
Wow.
But I was obsessed with Nabokov's Speak Memory, his autobiography, which I've read so many times that I sometimes think I wrote it. And so I did, but I didn't know anything. Because now if you look at some of the books like To Kill a Mockingbird or some classic books, those would be called YA. And then they weren't. Right. So I didn't understand. I still don't understand that when I wrote my book, I didn't know that it was YA. And that's why I'm here today, because I'm learning about what it is.
Oh, that's cool.
That makes a YA book. I still don't actually know.
A lot of YA authors say that they didn't realize they were writing a YA until, you know, agent or someone told them.
I actually believe that YA is just a way of selling.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think that it has anything to do at all with what's between the two covers. I think that I come from the movie business, so you look for a way to brand intellectual content. And it just so happens that in publishing right now, women call the shots, and young women have a lot of push, and boys seem to play video games and do other things, and that has left this area, this creative area, to women, and women write about things that boys profess to not be interested in. I think actually that's not true. But anyway, I think it's a way to sell, and I seem to notice that most of these readers of YA fiction aren't necessarily Y.
Totally,
I mean, they are.
That's true.
But, and so I am, let's see, I'm an adult, again, I'm 52, so I guess I'm an, you couldn't say YA, I'm old A, but I think it's great because it gives it a way, an umbrella to put it all under, but I don't think it means anything.
Right, yeah.
Probably because I don't understand it.
there's a lot to discuss there because it's true, it's mostly marketing, so it's interesting.
And also in my book has been sold to these other countries, and a lot of the other countries it's not YA. Mm.
Yeah.
And so I have to agree to that, and I only laugh. Like, what am I agreeing to?
Right.
You just bought it. You're going to sell it. So if you want to say it's a novel, then that's great.
Yeah. Yes, adults in the Netherlands are allowed to read this book.
Yeah, right.
I agree.
Well, you guys have a signing tomorrow, but before we wrap up, Cindy, can you tell us about the diversity in YA tour?
Oh, yeah. Well, that was mainly in May. So we hit, where did we go? We went to San Francisco, Austin, Chicago, New York, Boston. And it was started by Melinda Lowe and I. We had joked about touring together, and then both our books got pushed back to about within a week release of each other. Hers is Huntress, mine was Fury of the Phoenix. And so we said, let's tour together and let's just, you know, do it under the umbrella of diversity, because there had been so much talk about, you know, bringing more diverse characters and LGBT characters and just having more representation in novels. And from a writer's standpoint, the fear of writing outside of who you associate, like you identify yourself with, like if I'm not gay, can I write gay characters? And if I'm just, you know, if I'm Chinese, can I write a Persian character? You know, like stuff like that. And we just wanted to encourage and have that kind of dialogue and say, because I grew up reading books and nobody ever looked like me in any of the books I read.
Right.
And I'm not saying that, you know, I was devastated in any way. Obviously, I wasn't. But I realized in my 30s when I wrote my first novel, Silver Phoenix, I basically wrote the book that I wanted to read.
Mm-hmm.
As a teen that I never got to read. So I think that it's nice to see yourselves in books and to see other people in books and learn that way. You know, it's nice to be reflected, but it's nice to learn about other people who aren't like you. So that's what, it was just a big celebration of diversity.
So, and you're still doing, you have something.
We have one signing.
Right?
Yeah, we have one signing left in conjunction with World Fantasy Con. Holly Black will be in town. Paolo Bacigalupi, I think that's how you pronounce his name, and Cinda Williams Chima is coming, and Karen Healy from New Zealand hopefully will be able to make it. So Greg Van Eekhout, who's local to San Diego, and then Melinda Lowe. So we're going to have a big old panel and talk about, especially at World Fantasy Con, about diversity in fantasy and speculative fiction, which is even harder to write because there's so many dystopians, and there's a lot of dystopians where everybody's still Caucasian and straight.
Yeah.
Which is very, you know, I think for dystopian, it would be so interesting to make a whole world and see what it would be, how it would be different in, or actually reflective of how things are. So,
exactly.
Yeah.
That is too cool. Thank you for telling us all about this. And ladies, thank you so much. We'll wrap up now because I know you have a lot to get to with this conference. But Suzanne, Cindy, Nova, and Holly, thank you again so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having us.
Thanks again to these marvelous women for sitting down with us. You can find their books at your local bookstore. Again, Holly Goldberg Sloan's book is I'll Be There. Cindy Pond has Silver Phoenix and Fury of the Phoenix. Suzanne Young's newest book is A Need So Beautiful. And Nova Ren Suma's newest book is Imaginary Girls. Thanks again for listening. And be sure to tune in for our regular podcast, which is coming up in a couple weeks with Gretchen McNeil. Until then.